This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Amanda May Kim about her essay, California Obscura, which appears in the most recent issue of The Common in a portfolio of writing from the immigrant farmworker community. Amanda May Kim writes about the ways that collective power, racism, nature, and capitalism weave through the lives of rural Californians of color. Her work has appeared in Lit Hub, Hank, The New York Times, and Discover Nikkei. She grew up on a tenant farm in the agricultural worker community of Sadakoy, California. Amanda May Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to be here, Emily.
Would you set the scene for our conversation? Just describe where you're calling from now.
I'm calling from the Bay Area in San Mateo, California.
Awesome. I'm sure it's nicer there than it is here.
We're having some clear, beautiful, brisk weather.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we're getting towards spring, and today is the eclipse, so we're going to be pretty close to totality.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would love to start off with a reading from your essay. Would you read just the first two paragraphs for us?
I'd be happy to. In 1976, when I was 8 years old, my Korean-American father, a produce wholesaler and former farm worker, decided to become a full-time farmer. My Japanese-American mother, who descended from a long line of farmers and farm workers, wanted it too. They had spent their childhoods dreaming of a home on the land, so we moved from Los Angeles to a tenant farm 35 miles away. One afternoon, I was standing up to my shoulders in our new pea plants, which in the coastal light shone powder blue and silver, when a sedan with chrome trim pulled off the long frontage road. A woman in polyester shorts stepped out with a camera strapped around her neck. "Hello, little girl," she waved at me. "How cute. Aren't you supposed to have a little pail with you? Where's your little pail?" I pointed to my white 5-gallon bucket with the Kikkoman label, the kind my father picked up from restaurants when he delivered vegetables. "Lift it up," she said. "Show me." It was already half full, too heavy to lift. "Come over here. I want to take your picture. Hop over those plants." I turned away. I was not tall enough to hop over or foolish enough to harm a pea leaf or tendril for a photo. She curved her hands like a bunny, her tone sharpening ever so slightly. "Hop over." I ignored her. My orders came from the workers, my mother, the foreman, and ultimately my father. Over my shoulder, I heard my mother call from half a field away. "What are you doing?" Sure that she was talking to me, I put my head down and kept moving. The woman didn't respond either. She was lost in the viewfinder of her camera, framing me with a battered truck in the background, with the fluttering edge of a eucalyptus windbreak, with the stacks of full boxes, with the lemon groves that my father tended in exchange for this patch of land, with the other workers who were also listening, observing the woman. "Smile," she said when she had her shot.
Thank you for reading that. For our listeners who may not have read your essay yet, would you describe what the piece is about?
The piece is about my hometown, which is Sadakoy, California, which is a historically Chumash and farmworker community and has been for many years, many decades, in fact. And we're located in a part of California that's known as the Gold Coast. And it's a place that has had many forms of slavery over its time in Western history, beginning with the missions and continuing on to today in the form of farm worker slavery, indentured servitude, debt to the landlord, to the foreman, relationships with contractors that are exploitative. And so I'm writing about this long cycle of history that really does include this moment that I wrote about, which is the white gaze and how imperial forces, how capitalism looks at workers of color. Mm-hmm. And then Santa Cruz is also a place where there's been tremendous upheaval, riots, organizing. Workers in Santa Cruz have advocated for their own worker-owned housing. They've had strikes over decades. It's a place that is very famous for farm worker strikes and cross-racial strikes as well.
What inspired you to start work on this piece? I mean, it is so wide-ranging, as you just described, all these, you know, very different things that are all included in this essay. How did those early drafts come together?
Yeah, I mean, Emily, such a funny conversation, because I had started off with a different piece mm-hmm. that I had submitted, and you and I worked together quite a bit, and I had originally started with a story about my grandfather's uncle, who was the first person to come to the U.S. from Japan, mm-hmm. and he came as a farm worker, and he ended up in Hawaii, and he was murdered in Hawaii by a foreman. And our family never got his body back or even a death certificate. Mm-hmm. And so I had originally started with that story. And then I realized I needed to explain myself and how I interact with that history so that people can understand how I'm also part of this cycle. I grew up in this cycle mm-hmm. of exploited labor. It's not something that's just from the distant past. It's today, it's every day. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I'm glad you said that, because I do feel this piece has had a lot of different shapes. You know, as an editor, often the problem that we run into with writers, and I myself have this problem as a writer, is that people are reluctant to change things. You know, they sort of get their draft and they really want to, you know, they might change little words here and there, but they're reluctant to change things. And you, I would say, quite the opposite are... You know, we're eager to kind of go back and really drill down and see what felt important and what felt right to spend time on, as opposed to trying to preserve, you know, whatever the original form had been, which is so great. But also, because we've worked on so many drafts, I feel like I had this sense that you had so many stories and so many experiences, and also had done so much research about this history, that you could have written, you know, 10 different essays on farm work in California for this portfolio. I'm wondering, like, how did you decide what to focus on, or how do you feel about this as the final version? I know you're hoping to work on things that are longer and you know, can encompass more ideas.
Right. So I think for me, one of the editing choices, one of the editorial choices, was shifting the frame and really looking at, well, what does a more mainstream or in some ways a wider audience than I might find in California, how would they react to this content? And what do they need to know in order to fully appreciate it? You know, one of the risks and dangers of telling farm worker stories is that it becomes a story of abject poverty or kind of a humbling, a nothing but humbling experience. And so the humanity behind farm workers, and really the ingenuity, the work, the resilience, the creativity, all of that, you know, unless you know and you see it, you might not realize it, because most of our narratives really don't describe farm workers as fully human. And so I felt that I needed to go back and use the tools that were available to me to tell this broader story about farm workers, and also humanize them and demonstrate the different ways that farm workers have enormous knowledge. And for me, that was a wonderful learning. There's a section in this essay where one of the people who's been in my family's life, a farm worker, but would always come back and forth and stay with us, beginning with my grandfather when he was a sharecropper, to my own childhood. His name was Juan Garcia, and he always gathered up all the hottest peppers and stems and would feed them to his favorite chicken, then kind of the rooster who was in charge of the flock. And I never knew why he did that, but I looked it up more recently, and there's been recent research that that capsaicin is really good for chickens, and it boosts their immune health, and it makes them stronger. And so there was a really good reason that he was doing that. And that was before the evidence base was developed, right? So I think I was navigating all of that. What's the difference between knowledge and book learning and traditional knowledge? What's been passed down through our ancestors? What we know and learn from observation versus from what we gather in books. So those were some of the other themes.
One thing you mentioned in this essay is that so many of California's essential farm workers in the 40s and 50s were Japanese Americans who had just been released from camps that they had been confined in during the war. And they had lost everything. They had no homes. So they were, in a way, sort of perfectly suited to itinerant farm work. You know, they didn't have homes, things to bring with them. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah. So let me start by saying that the way Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, many Korean Americans, Sikhs, Yemenis, Armenians, who are considered Asian at the time, many hundreds of thousands came to California as farm workers, Filipinos as well. And when all of these groups immigrated, they all had different legal statuses and requirements. Filipinos were not allowed to marry white women, for example, but also were not allowed to bring their families. Japanese could bring their families up to a certain point. You know, so there are a lot of ways in which farm worker lives were regulated, and regulated in a way in which they could not be fully human. When they were in this country, they were really designated as workers. And so policies from the very start, and beginning obviously with Native Americans and African Americans who are enslaved, you know, our governments have had a role in dehumanizing people of color. And so that continues on prior to the incarceration of Japanese Americans. And then after the incarceration, people didn't have a place to go, and they ended up, many as farm workers living in camps. And then also, you know, there were some Japanese Americans who did have property. Most did not, because of alien land laws that restricted their ownership. But some did, and they took in many, many families as well. So there are many stories of caretaking within the community, or churches and temples or community centers, where they supported each other after incarceration.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because I think one of the most interesting aspects of this essay is how you examine the efforts of people in this community to help each other, and to sort of say, you know, your fight is my fight, I think is how you sort of end the essay. And a lot of that is these efforts of immigrant farm workers to come together across racial and ethnic divides, to fight for better working conditions and those kind of things. And it sounds to me from your essay that that perhaps the powers that be were trying to keep them racially divided, or to encourage those divisions in order to prevent them from unifying. Was it important to you to show that aspect?
It was important to show that aspect. So, the U.S. was the birthplace of eugenics and this idea of a hierarchy of races, and that definitely manifests in policy, foreign policy, as well as domestic policy, and especially around workers. And yes, many were immigrants when they first came to this country, but they were also naturalized citizens. They were also born in the U.S. citizens too. And so there are plenty of farm workers in communities today in California and beyond who are born in the U.S., who are U.S. citizens, and who represent, you know, are Native American, are Black, are really very diverse in their ethnicity. So I do think that there's plenty of evidence historically that demonstrates that the federal government, which is responsible for immigration policy, corporations, landowners, believe that racial divides were useful to keeping the workforce down. And there's still examples today in Tulare County. In Poplar, there are plenty of Filipino, Yemeni, and Mexican workers. And some workers by race are given a little bit more money. Some are given less. Some are given better housing, some are given worse, but it's defined by race. And it's designed to produce antipathy and a lack of coordination. But at the same time, there's plenty of evidence that also shows that workers have united across racial divides, across languages. So one of the big significant farm worker strikes took place in 1903 in Oxnard, California, and it involved thousands of workers. Most were Japanese, and I think about a third were Mexican, and across every possible barrier, social barrier, which is language, which is upbringing, citizenship status, faith, they worked together to really win that strike. And unfortunately, after they won that strike and truly demonstrated that workers of color could lead an effective strike, only the Mexican workers were allowed membership in the national union. The Japanese workers were not. And so the Mexican workers said, we don't want to be a part of this organization. And so, I think that represents what happens a lot in terms of cross-racial efforts, right? That we would have a different food system if the majority white-led unions had let in Japanese workers.
Wow. You know, it's just reminding me of something I think you said to me while we were working on edits. I'm not sure. I don't think it's in the final version of the essay, but that you said in your research and that you've been doing that most of the agricultural land in California is owned by people who have never stepped foot in California. Am I remembering that right?
Most of the agricultural land is owned by people who, I mean, historically, this is true too, do not live on the land. And then it might be true now that most do not live in California. I'm not sure about that. There's a lot of land that's owned by hedge funds, that's owned by large corporations.
Yeah, we invited you to our launch event in LA and you weren't able to attend, unfortunately. But one of the things that came up there was... some of our farm worker guests were talking about the farms they had worked at where the farmer was there and the farmer was great and really good to work for. And the comparison between that and these really vast farms that are owned by, like you said, hedge funds or multinational companies that, you know, are not worried about their workers or any kind of relationship with their workers. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad to hear that. And I think that there is a tradition of providing better care to workers. I grew up in a rented house that was designed for a ranch foreman, and two of the bathrooms had exterior doors, and so that's designed clearly for workers, and also outside toilets. And it was a cluster of houses where workers could live, including people who worked for my father, who was a tenant farmer. So I think there were a lot of different configurations, including larger family or kin. Who are farm workers as well. That's definitely very common too. But your story makes me reflect on how important it is to have some additional supports for farm workers, because my thought could be that because they had a good farmer who wasn't constantly exploiting them, who wasn't calling the INS on them at the end of the season so the farmer wouldn't have to pay their last check, who allowed them to be stable, it enabled them in turn to get college degrees, to become writers, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I think that is, if there's a takeaway from all of these stories, it's really that even just a small, relatively small investment in farm worker communities or farm worker children really yields huge change and opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. I have felt that again and again as I've, read the work that's in this portfolio, because of course, the work we receive is often from people who did farm work when they were younger and have since, gone to college. Some of them are professors now, and you just think about sort of the circumstances that had to align for that to be possible for them, yeah. And of course, the issue being that we can't, you can't count on the goodness of one person or one owner, or one farmer. And so that's why you have to have these protections and these, unions and things like that, because,
Right. Yeah.
yeah, you can't count on, oh, the circumstances perfectly aligning or working out just right. Yeah.
Right, right. And policy environments that are good for, I mean, I think we're not really talking about the writing anymore, but that's fine for me. But policy environments that are good for farm workers are good for everyone. I mean, to have water, to have protections against sun exposure, to understand how to protect people from polluted air, to limit the level of pollution in the air, to provide clean water. Like, farm workers are at the front line of not just providing food, but also of addressing environmental issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I just, another thing, I'm just thinking of another moment in your essay that I haven't stopped thinking about is the idea that the cartoon character Popeye is based on Braceros. I was wondering, I'm sure that some of our listeners don't know about Braceros, just like I didn't when I started working on the farm worker portfolio. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the Bracero program was I'm going to speak in a very limited fashion about this because I don't feel like it's my domain to speak on. But I'll just provide a little bit of background as it relates to my essay. So the Bracero program was a program that involved bringing workers from Mexico to the U.S. temporarily, and then they would go back home. And so they would go back and forth. And this was a way in which, as we were talking about earlier, groups are pitted against each other. Mm. So this immigrant program, this migrant program, kind of pitted this new group against people who are established in the U.S. as situated farm workers, right? Mm. And so there was a lot of conflict between braceros and people who are here already as farm workers and who are citizen farm workers. And so even Cesar Chavez was advocating for the sighted farm workers in Oxnard versus the braceros who came back and forth. And so I wanted to just shed a little bit of light on that bracero because he was an itinerant worker, but he had long roots to our family. He had multi-generational connections to our family. You know, he did not speak English. My grandfather, who initially hired him, did not speak Spanish. Juan would come and have dinner at my grandfather's house every night before my grandfather would drive him back to the camp. And my uncles each visited Juan in Guanajuato because they really respected and admired him. And so even this conception of the bracero worker as kind of temporary work, one where you don't have roots, that section was really designed to show, hey, look, no, actually, we have long roots. Mm-hmm. And he shows up in my life, and our family's life between 1952-ish to 1992, over 40 years. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a section in which my mother is explaining the bracero program to me as a child, and she's really admiring what good workers they are. She's really trying to upend the stereotypes of the bracero with me as a child. And I said to her, oh, so he's like, they're like Popeye, right? With the big arms. And she's like, oh yeah, they're just like Popeye. And, there's a way in which, children of color have to tell their own stories and be told their own narratives because the ones presented in the mainstream are really harmful. And so it's pretty common for a stereotype to get flipped a little bit. So it shows the good side of a person, their full humanity, what they did contribute, versus kind of a flat character. Mm-hmm. So that is an example of childhood critical race theory from my mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually the perfect segue. I was going to ask you, so much of this essay follows you through sort of key moments from your childhood. And it really did make me notice these moments where you're learning about not just your family's history, but, the history of farm work and labor and that kind of thing from the people around you, from your mother, from, hearing people talk about strikes and that kind of thing. Um, and, And I assume some of the research and histories that's in the essay you learned later, and some of it you heard from those stories as a child. I'm just wondering, like, what was it like reflecting on those memories, trying to connect kind of the things you heard when you were young and the things you know now?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think for me, because I do have two master's degrees and I got the MFA, and what the interesting process for me now is to look at what I know, the information that I know, and I know it, I'm not even sure how I know it, right, from childhood. And then to analyze it through the lens of what academia understands today. And so that's been just a really fascinating gap, because much of my work actually emerges from the knowing, from what I experienced and saw, how people would talk about things. And then I only use that academic resource to validate it for a broader audience. So I'll give you another example. My grandparents were part of a 40-farmer collective in Palos Verdes, California, which is a very affluent neighborhood. And they were dry farmers, and so they didn't use any kind of irrigation. Mm. And there is no contemporary documentation of people being able to grow vegetables in a climate like Los Angeles's without irrigation. And so I need to go into different kinds of records to validate that that was the case. And so then I produced the leases that said that they were not allowed to put in water tanks or to have irrigation, right? And so I've had to reconstruct what I know through like publicly accepted knowledge bases. So it's been a very interesting process for me, because it's a very convoluted way to arrive at something that you already know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I'm just thinking, you know, you said like, oh, we're not talking much about the writing anymore. And that's certainly true. But I'm just thinking about, you know, you have your MFA. And it sounds like, you know, when you were writing this, and probably when you're writing lots of things, you have to think about what, you know, a broader, maybe less educated or more white audience might, you know, need to understand what you're saying. How do you feel like writing creatively, like writing creative nonfiction that is very, you know, that is not reporting, you know, that is not just, you know, dry research or just academic. How do you feel like that, you know, that helps you communicate what you want to communicate?
Yeah. Thank you. So I think that I'm writing for an audience that's both within the community that I'm writing from and about. And I always share my writing with the people who are represented in my stories. And so in this story, I included this Aguachiles place in Oxnard, owned by a guy named Julian. And before I approved the copy with you, Emily, I actually sent it to Julian to see what he thought about it and to see if he approved. And so there's a way in which I try to do that work fully, remain fully connected to and beholden to and accountable to people I would consider my community, or at least who are represented in my stories. And then the other part of it, though, is to remember that when, if I were to bring anyone into my home, I would explain things to them. I would share things with them. I would give them the background. I would let them know about a loose floorboard or a deaf uncle, right? And so I feel like some of that work with the audience, whether it's white or whether it's Asian, Mexican American, Black, you know, there's the role of the narrator is to navigate and to help you see and understand what's going on within this story. So I feel like that's definitely part of my role.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I love that. You'd have to let us know about the loose floorboards. Yeah, absolutely. So beyond writing, you know, I took a glance at your LinkedIn while I was preparing for our conversation, you know, just to see what you're doing when you're not writing. And it seems like you're doing everything. You're working on so many different projects, and they all sound really interesting. How would you describe your work?
Yeah, I would say that I'm really fortunate to be working right now in three areas that are very important to me, that are interrelated, and where I have some fluency in. And so one of those areas is I am the executive director for a community of practice of women who are working on agriculture and equity issues. I am also the lead researcher for a new project called Concha History, in which I have gathered together the property transfer records of 6,000 Japanese American farmers in California, and I'm working with volunteers to transcribe those transfer documents. And then I do a lot of work around ethnic media. Ethnic media has been in the U.S. since the 1600s and continues to be kind of the backbone lifeblood of communities, even though it's a system that's largely outside of mainstream news.
Right. Wow. Yeah, those all sound so fascinating and important. And always the last question we ask everyone on the podcast is just what you're working on now in terms of writing. What's next? What should we look for from you?
Thanks for this question. So I'm working on my chapter outline currently for a larger memoir that covers, it's a memoir and essay that covers all of these topics, but in a fuller format that begins in Hawaii, that ends with the present day, and the activism work that I still find myself doing, still find myself being invited to participate in for either multiracial farm workers or farmers who are just trying to keep a little toehold on the land, but local governments harass them. They're not, you know, there are a lot of restrictions around how to operate. And so I find myself writing about this cycle that began for my family 125 years ago and which continues today until we really disrupt the system. And if there's a closing note, I would say that we have to disrupt the system because the way we're headed is incredibly damaging to our environment. We're running out of water. The land is being untenable. And so we have to make some type of change in how we view food and people. And so, and at the heart of it, really, it's still farm workers. Mm-hmm. How we treat farm workers is really such an indicator of who we are as a society.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for giving us that last note. I'm glad you returned to that use of the word cycle that we sort of started the podcast with, because that does feel, yeah, I felt that a lot when I was working on the portfolio and, you know, the people who maybe are able to step outside of the cycle and the people who aren't, you know, the people who are left behind. And yeah, until something big changes, you know, these like, yeah, I don't think that we need small incremental change at this point.
Well, you know, in terms of farm worker assistance, it really, there are so many on the ground community-based organizations that really directly serve farm workers. Mm. And if every American family that can afford it, you know, could donate to these organizations, it would really transform things. And so, you know, Emily, if you want to include the links or something like that, I'd be happy to provide you with 10 links. And the corporate agriculture folks don't want to pay farm workers more because it increases their power. It gives them greater choice.
Yeah.
And I think that's incredibly exploitative. And so the end run around that is for people to directly donate to the farm workers who give them a healthy life every day.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love it if you would send us some links. We can include them in the show notes and on our website. And yeah, I've also I can also let people know in our local area, we've been working with the Pioneer Valley Workers Center, which is an organization in Western Massachusetts that helps farm workers, you know, with basic assistance, but also a lot of learning, you know, self-advocacy and that kind of thing for change. Yeah,
that sounds great.
Well, Amanda Mae Kim, thank you so much for joining us, for talking with us. It's been so great just going through these things with you.
Thank you so much, Emily. I really appreciate you.
Listeners, you can read Amanda's essay and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.